loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a federal judge in California has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from denying asylum claims made outside of legal checkpoints, dealing a setback to the president's efforts to halt thousands of migrants making their way from Central America to the U.S. border. Next, Airbnb announced yesterday that it would withdraw all listings for homes in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, saying that those settlements were at the core of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Israel's tourism minister said he would sue the company immediately. Also yesterday, an Israeli sniper shot an AP cameraman with a press jacket on. Then the White House yesterday reinstated the press credentials of CNN correspondent Jim Acosta, but not until drafting new rules, saying that any reporter who asks a follow-up question without permission could then lose his or her press credentials. CNN has dropped its lawsuit against Trump. Meanwhile, the White House Correspondents Association, apparently bowing to Trump, announced that it would not have a comedian at its annual dinner this year, but instead will have a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian speak. Last year's speaker, comedian Michelle Wolf, called the association today a bunch of cowards. And then the Trump administration is preparing to add Venezuela to the list of state sponsors of terrorism in what would be a dramatic escalation of the conflict between the two countries. The list of state sponsors of terrorism is for countries, quote, that repeatedly provide support for acts of international terrorism, unquote, and it currently includes only Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. And finally, President Trump yesterday picked a Twitter fight with Pakistan over what he called that country's refusal to do anything to help the United States. Pakistan summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest, and Prime Minister Imran Khan took to Twitter to rebut Trump's allegations. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the federal courts. A federal judge in California has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from denying asylum claims made outside of legal checkpoints, dealing a setback to the president's efforts to halt thousands of migrants making their way from Central America to the U.S. border. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Welcome back, Juan Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Can you explain to our listeners what this means exactly? Tell us the modus operandi for actually requesting asylum. Where do you have to do that?
When people come through the border, at least, the Central American people that have been flowing through our gates and flooding the gates, they usually hand themselves over to Border Patrol. Border Patrol is the ones in charge of, accepting the people. They basically do an interview, a credible fear interview, to evaluate the claims. Most of these people are being persecuted. Most of these people are being searched for in their countries, be it by organized cartels, by gangs, or even the government, in their repressive measures against them. So these people are being displaced by the violence in their home countries. We have to remember that we are talking about Central America, Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras, and now Nicaragua, that seem to be kind of boiling over with a great deal of violence, in which our country has been complicit in many ways, from setting a puppet regime in Honduras, which destabilized the whole country in 2009. This is a direct result of that intervention and our economic foreign policies that are being implemented in those countries. I am not taking away the responsibility of our home countries, but it does have a lot to do with a system in place, a system that basically, puts money, resources before people, before the well-being, the dignity of people. So that's what we are seeing today. So they come through, they hand themselves over to Border Patrol, and Border Patrol has the capacity to look into their claims for asylum. At this point, because our president wanted to close down the doors. There is not much possibility for asylum. And certainly that law that he wanted to implement and that the court practically says that it's not possible, it's not going to happen. He basically wanted to shut down the doors. And when we talk about a wall, there is a wall right there already. But, you know, I was telling some friends that the harm is already done. Mm-hmm. Whenever somebody in power that says something, you know, signals or proclaims or irresponsibly uses rhetoric that violates, that infringes upon the human rights of individual, even if it doesn't become a law or is signed into a law, a lot of the people who are dealing with these migrants, these caravans, mm-hmm. get the message that they can be justified. They get emboldened just by such rhetoric, by the irresponsible words of those in power, and they practically do whatever they want. So it creates a milieu, it creates a culture of practically anything goes. It's an open season for all.
We're speaking with Juan Carlos Ruiz, the co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Brian, I was going to say, you know, we have very clear rules about applying for asylum, and it seems that the administration has just turned this into a slow motion train wreck.
Yeah. Well, I want to try to introduce some of the basic ideas about how the process actually works, mm-hmm. and use the judge's ruling from yesterday to help explain it, and very briefly, and then we'll go back to Juan Carlos. So what basically has happened is that Donald Trump signed a proclamation on November 9th that banned migrants from applying for asylum if they failed to make the request at a legal checkpoint, meaning at a legal port of entry. What the judge, John S. Tiger of the United States District Court in San Francisco, ruled is that you can't use this one single criteria, meaning you didn't come through a port of entry, you came in through some other means, as the sole basis to determine whether or not you had a credible asylum claim. Just think about it in a practical sense. Let's say you're being chased by people who are by a death squad, and they're going to kill you, and you want to seek asylum in the United States, but you can't get to the port of entry at the U.S.-Mexican border at the bridge. Or perhaps Donald Trump's administration has closed that port of entry, which they were doing.
Which they've done, yes.
So you go a mile away from the bridge, and you come across the border, and then you turn yourself into Border Patrol and say, I just came across, I'm being pursued, I will be killed unless I get asylum, and now I want to have my asylum claim judged, right? That's the process. What Donald Trump was basically saying is, nope, sorry, you have to go back and face the people who are about to kill you because you didn't come across at the bridge. You went a mile up the road and crossed over there. So the judge basically said, no, that doesn't work. That's unconstitutional, meaning there's laws and rules about asylum, and the president does not have the authority basically to issue a proclamation undoing those laws. Those are the laws of the land. Now, Juan Carlos, this is a temporary restraining order. It comes back in December before the courts. Ultimately, Donald Trump is going to want this to go to the Supreme Court because he's got his friends there, like Brett Kavanaugh and these other Republican operatives who he hopes will do his bidding. And at the same time, this is such a clear violation of the law and the president's prerogatives. It sets up a really important legal case. Go ahead.
Yes. I mean, once again, you know, this administration is one of the hallmark characteristics of this administration is that of bullying. And we are seeing that. And there is a method and a strategy to it. And you just pointed it out, you know, he has his friends in the Supreme Court. So, and as I said, once it is, those words are parted from the lips of this powerful man, anything goes. I mean, people get the message, you know, our communities are very much in fear because all this rhetoric, irresponsible rhetoric, you know, camouflage with a racial discriminatory, you know, overtones. It does. You know, I keep telling people, for many people, this is politics. But for our people on the ground, for people who are being persecuted, people who are being hunted by these death squads, this is survival. This is a matter of life and death. And what we are doing with this, just by accepting, you know, such irresponsible rhetoric coming from these powerful men, you know, we are allowing them to create conditions so violent that people have to choose between, you know, spending many years in jail, you know, here in the United States, or going back to their home countries where a certain death awaits them. It is irresponsible to have such talk. And, you know, we need to denounce that. Their rhetoric, you know, racist rhetoric coming from the administration has to be pointed out. And also the whole infrastructure. You know, we have to talk about this infrastructure of terror, which is Homeland Security. Last year, the budget was $78 billion. Of course, you know, a lot of this infrastructure is in the hands of private companies that have little to nothing monitoring or check or balances. So it is eroding the democratic values that we saw, you know, have as pillars of our society. I mean, this, I always say, you know, remember, these are the front lines. Immigrants are the front lines. But, you know, next to them, it's naturalized citizens. Next to elderly are our children. And, you know, this it's a really a mock capitalistic system.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Airbnb announced yesterday that it would withdraw all listings for homes in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, saying that those settlements were at the core of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Israel's tourism minister said he would sue the company immediately. Also yesterday, an Israeli sniper shot an Associated Press cameraman with a press jacket on. We're joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Welcome back, Ariel.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Ariel, the BBC says that this is the first good news for the BDS movement in a very long time. The Israeli tourism minister said that he's going to sue Airbnb. Airbnb thinks that it's an empty threat. Tell us how important this decision is.
Well, we've been working on this for almost 3 years. Around 3 years ago, a coalition of organizations, including Code Pink, Jewish Voice for Peace, some of us, and many others came together, and we started campaigning to get Airbnb out of the settlements. We protested in front of their offices, in front of offices of their investors. We disrupted events. We ran social media campaigns, collected over 150,000 signatures.
Wow.
And now we are seeing the fruits of our labor paying off. And this is a real win, not only for Palestinian rights, but for social justice organizing in general, right? This is a show of that when we come together and we work together and when we fight for a cause, we win.
Human Rights Watch lauded this decision in an announcement today and said that what they have to do now, what really all of us have to do now, is move on to other organizations, other companies like Booking.com, to get them to make the same decision and to pull out of the West Bank. Is that your next move as well?
Absolutely. So, you know, along with Airbnb, there has always been, as you said, Booking.com, Expedia, Priceline, Travelocity, and others that are continuing to list homes in the West Bank as well as in East Jerusalem. And I should say the caveat that Airbnb has not announced they'll be removing their listings in East Jerusalem. But this is the beginning of what we're looking at as a much larger campaign, calling on these tourist industry companies to get out of the business of profiting off of human rights abuses. You know, not just on Airbnb's site, but these other travel sites, these bed and breakfasts, and in some cases hotels, they're listed as being in Israel. So if you're a tourist and you go to vacation in Israel and you look to book a hotel at the Dead Sea, you have no idea that you're crossing into occupied, stolen Palestinian land because these companies are complicit.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was surprised to see in Haaretz this morning an op-ed written by David Rosenberg, who writes frequently for Haaretz, saying this is really no big deal for Israel. It's entitled Airbnb's Ban on Israeli Settlements is a Big Win for BDS. It won't even scratch the Israeli economy or even that of the settlements, he says, but it did drive the government into hysterics. So why was the government driven into hysterics?
This is a government that is so bent on supporting settlements, right? We often don't realize how much Israel as a government supports these settlements. Living in the settlements is subsidized, public transportation to get to the settlements, your home in the settlements is subsidized. And what had happened when we first launched the Airbnb campaign, the Stolen Homes campaign to get Airbnb out of the settlements, was that settlers responded by putting out even more listings. And in many cases, these weren't booked very often. You know, he's correct. This doesn't scratch the Israeli economy. This was not the majority of listings. But Israel is intent on protecting its military occupation, on propping up its occupation. So, you know, we saw really the Minister of Tourism and the Minister of the Interior have a temper tantrum. They threatened lawsuits, as you said, and they've also threatened to reduce Airbnb's business inside of the legal boundaries of Israel, what we as activists often call 48 Palestine. You know, as activists, we think, bring it on. That's fantastic. Just isolate yourselves more and show your cards.
I have to say, too, this is inspirational for someone like me who follows the Greek and Cyprus or Cypriot issue as closely as I do. The northern third of Cyprus has been occupied by the Turkish military since 1974. And I would be absolutely livid if there were Airbnb rooms and apartments and houses available in the occupied part of Cyprus. So I think this is really something that other people, other groups, other organizations can and should emulate, because with hard work, you actually get results.
And these settlements, all of the settlements, are a violation of international law. They are illegal. They are on stolen land that was stolen by the State of Israel in the June 1967 war. UN resolutions and resolutions that the United States government has supported in the past say the settlements in the West Bank are illegal. And here you have, and only because of extreme pressure from Ariel Gold and other activists and Code Pink, who have, you know, raised the flag and made the expose, has Airbnb finally bowed to what should have been simple. You can't be doing business with homes that are illegally constructed on other people's lands on occupied territory. Go ahead, Ariel.
You know, some of these were in outposts, which are not only illegal under international law, flagrant violations, they're called, but outposts are even illegal under Israeli law. And there were outposts scattered throughout the West Bank as well that were listed. You know, we took a lot of our lead as well from watching other movements around Airbnb. So, for example, there was the campaign Airbnb While Black to address the racism that Airbnb was complicit in. And that resulted in a real change from Airbnb. We saw them come out with a solid, thorough anti-discrimination policy. So we knew this was a company that was movable. And we're also still aware that there are anti-gentrification activists around the country that are affected by Airbnb's policies and that are continuing to campaign. So we hope that this success is encouragement for them as well.
I want to ask you in our last 3.5 or so minutes about this Associated Press cameraman who was shot by an Israeli sniper. He was clearly wearing a press jacket, a bright jacket that identified him as a member of the media. He was shot by the sniper. This is not the first time this has happened. Why do things like this happen? If it's clear that this is a member of the media, why would the Israelis continue to shoot?
You know, there's a really clear answer to that, and that's because Israel is not held accountable. Since March 30th, Israel has shot and either killed or severely has killed over 200 people. They have injured many, resulting in amputations, thousands of people, and yet to any type of accountability at all. They simply say that they're investigating themselves, and that's if it even gets that far. Among those killed have been, as you said, reporters. This is not the first one. Children, medics, elderly people. This is nothing new. Israel has, you know, since it was founded, been murdering civilians, and they continue to act with impunity. And so it's our job as activists to hold them accountable and to lift up these stories and to demand justice and an end to the horrific siege on Gaza.
Yeah, I'm looking at a piece in Time magazine that was released this morning talking about this AP cameraman who was shot and wounded. His name was Rashid Rashid, 47 years old. He was hit in the leg during the weekly Friday protest along the fence line with Gaza. He suffered multiple broken bones above the ankle and is in surgery right now. He was operating a live camera on an elevated area overlooking the protest. He was 600 meters away from the fence, wearing a blue helmet and a brown protective vest with the word press written in white. It was clear that he was a member of the media.
And the Israelis, John, I think they want to make it very, very clear to the media. If you go and cover Palestinian peaceful protests, we're going to shoot you.
We're going to shoot you.
But Israel, yeah, absolutely. They target press. But they also, we have seen clear patterns of targeting the legs. They're targeting people's legs, and they're doing so with these expanding butterfly bullets. And the aim there is severe injury, enormous numbers of amputations. And this is to create a collective memory in Palestinian society of the price that you'll pay, while still attempting to keep the casualty number just low enough. And Israel actually calculates these kinds of things as to try to keep worldview from paying attention. So this is a really insidious and disgusting plan by the Israeli military.
That was the voice of Ariel Gold, who joined us from Washington. Ariel is a noted peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The White House yesterday reinstated the press credentials of CNN correspondent Jim Acosta, but not until drafting new rules saying that any reporter who asks a follow-up question without permission could then lose his or her press credentials. CNN has dropped its lawsuit against Trump. Meanwhile, the White House Correspondents Association, apparently bowing to the president, announced that it would not have a comedian at its annual dinner this year, but instead will have a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian to speak. Last year's speaker, comedian Michelle Wolf, called the association a bunch of cowards. We'll talk about that with Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome back, Tim.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Oh, Tim, this just sounds like it's not going to be any fun at all. You've got these Reagan-era rules now where you have to sit quietly and raise your hand. You're not allowed to ask follow-up questions, or you risk having your press pass revoked, your White House pass revoked. And then you can't even go to a fun dinner with a comedian to, you know, make fun of the president like every other president has done. Now you have to listen to a guy who's an expert on James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. What's going on here?
Well, I think that the Washington Press Corps is afraid of a lot of things. And one of the things that they're afraid of is are being advocates for themselves. And when you have these sorts of situations where one of theirs is threatened by the White House, is banned from access by the White House, there is a tendency for them not to join together in protest but to sort of quietly back away. Now, the Jim Acosta situation did see something unusual in that a number of news organizations, including Fox News, which is largely supportive of President Trump's attack on the media, sign onto an amicus brief in the CNN case against the White House in support of Jim Acosta and his right to be reinstated. So there is some organizing going on there, but by and large, journalists are very reluctant activists, and they're very reluctant advocates for themselves, which is a difficult position to take at a time when you have a president who makes, you know, attacks on the media one of his signature issues.
It seems to me that this was more or less a victory for Trump, this whole CNN and Acosta.
I totally
thing.
Agree.
Because they went to court, they got, as Tim is mentioning, even Fox News, a conservative rival, supporter of Trump, to sign on with them. But the agreement that they came to stipulated, look, the press just has to behave even better. In other words, more passive, more contrite going forward. And it seems to me that the bottom line for CNN is just that they want to be in the room, that there's no tenacious defense of an independent media whatsoever. In fact, the whole thing starts to ring hollow to me, because the same media, say Julian Assange, is now, we know, is going to be prosecuted. As Glenn Greenwald said in The Intercept today, even the Obama administration recognized that prosecuting people who published documents that had been obtained perhaps illegally, but were truthful documents, were real documents, were documents that investigative journalism thrives on, that would set a dangerous precedent. Now you have, we know for a fact that Julian Assange is being targeted for prosecution. The same media that use WikiLeaks revelations cover them, have covered them. They don't say a word in defense of, like, this outlier, Julian Assange, or other alternative media. It seems like it's real timidity as the rule, not the exception.
I think what you're seeing, and what has been a problem, particularly with the press in Washington, D.C., is the victory of access journalism over adversarial journalism. Access journalism dictates that you have to get along with the powers that be in order to gain access to those stories. And I would submit that there's a good chance that if you were a journalist covering the White House, you'd find a better story walking out of the White House press room, walking across the mall, and having a conversation with the first person you encounter, because all that you're getting inside that press room is really tightly controlled messages delivered with a great deal of animosity by a press secretary who will not go deep, will not admit that her boss is lying, not give straight answers to questions. So the question for me is, like, why don't they do something else? Why don't they send their interns into the White House just to keep the cameras rolling and maybe capture a clip if needed, and spend their time walking the streets, getting out, getting the story from the people out in the field, rather than trying to gain access to a White House that's not going to give them anything.
Tim, you are absolutely right. What's the answer to your question?
Well, the answer is that they should, and that they should invest more in the type of investigative journalism that challenges authority. And rather than putting their top journalists in a job where the president just demeans them, send them out into the field. Send them out to get those stories. Send them to investigate the president's businesses, for example. Investigate a lot of these issues that they're asking questions about, questions that they're not getting answers to in the White House. Go out into the field and do the investigative work that really does fulfill the central mandate of journalism, which is to challenge authority.
Tim Carr is our guest. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. John, when you think about what happened starting with the first Iraq war, the first Gulf War, and then Afghanistan, the second Iraq war, you had this new thing called embedded journalism. And the embedded journalists, they went with the army. They went with the bombing missions. They went as sort of chroniclers of our side fighting its war. In order to have that kind of access, as Tim is making the point, you also have to not simply not reveal military secrets, you basically have to feed the narrative.
Sure.
Because otherwise the Pentagon doesn't want to embed you. They don't want to embed you so that you can say, hey, the military is carrying out war crimes, for instance, or we just blew up a school, or you know, we a bunch of farmers in Iraq just got blown away by anti-tank missiles.
And we saw that famously in the case of the New York Times and its coverage of the Iraq War.
Yeah,
which was really little more than propaganda.
And then when you go back, Tim, to the election campaign itself, like now CNN is all against Trump. Okay, but during the run-up during the 2016 campaign, because it was about ratings, same with CBS, same with CNN, they were all about, you know, embedding with Trump. And they didn't want to really antagonize Trump at that time because he was good for ratings. I mean, it's corrupt.
Well, yes, I mean, CNN's chief, Jeff Zucker, has admitted as much, as did Les Moonves when he was with CBS, that Trump is good television, Trump is good for ratings, and you know, so for them, the decision to carry press conferences live or to carry his campaign rallies live was sort of a no-brainer from a business perspective because it drew people to their television stations. And this is one of the problems. I mean, it's really interesting to me that you mentioned the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003 when mainstream media was in lockstep with the then Bush administration's view about weapons of mass destruction and their justification going into Iraq as justification for stopping that potential threat. Of course, we've since learned that it never existed. But that was really the beginning of the media reform movement, the movement that my organization works on. We had such a level of anger in the public with the way the media handled the run-up to the war that they were looking for alternatives. And one of the problems that we see in all of this is when you have very large consolidated media companies that have not only in the business of producing news, but have an entertainment industry, have a whole range of amusement parks that have a whole range of businesses. You have these conflicts where having a news component to your conglomerate could pose threats to your other businesses should that news organization do its job and question authority. These companies have any number of policy issues before government, and it's in their interest to do favors for government in exchange for the kind of policies that they need in order to grow bigger and to continue to grow their businesses.
I want to ask you if the problem is one of investment. You said earlier that outlets need to invest more in investigative journalism. I think that's absolutely true. There are so few outlets that do invest in journalism now. Is this a problem of revenue? Can we overcome this and get back to the business of investigative journalism?
It is a problem of revenue for a lot of news organizations, as we've seen in the last 15 years, really with the rise of social media, that the revenue model for traditional journalism, which was you know, advertising for television and radio, has dried up. And a lot of that revenue is now going to companies like Facebook and Google. So there is a real dilemma there, is how do we reinvest in the type of investigative reporting that we need at a time when the business model for journalism is under threat?
Tim Carr, we have 1 minute left. I mean, the fact that the Press Corps annual dinner is now not going to have a comedian. You know, Michelle Wolf at the last correspondence dinner, she didn't just attack Trump. She also attacked the media.
Oh, totally.
She really went after the media for not standing up to Trump. And as a consequence, neither Trump nor these corporate mega monopoly media institutions actually want to do anything that risque. The minimizing of risk and going along the normalcy of all things, even outrageous things, and the genuflecting before authority, I mean, it really does demonstrate the need for a free press, meaning for an alternative media or a breakup of this mega monopoly system. Is that possible?
It's possible, but it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of work to get a diversified media ownership in this country. There's a lot of ways that you can do it, and we've been working on diversifying ownership of broadcast and newspaper media conglomerates, but we have this new beast today in the form of internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T that are buying into media as well. So the work, that is the central work of Free Press, is to address media consolidation and try to figure out how to create a diverse ownership that will create news organizations that aren't part of these conglomerates that are in the legitimate business of challenging authority.
We will leave it there. That was the voice of Tim Carr, who joined us from Washington. Tim is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is preparing to add Venezuela to the list of state sponsors of terrorism in what would be a dramatic escalation of the conflict between the two countries. The list of state sponsors of terrorism is for countries, quote, that repeatedly provide support for acts of international terrorism, unquote, and currently includes only Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. We're joined from Los Angeles by Jeanette Charles. She's a writer, editor, and solidarity liaison with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Jeanette, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jeanette, the state sponsors of terrorism list is maintained by the State Department. And I can tell you, as a former CIA officer, we always knew it was just a political tool to put pressure on countries that we didn't have good relations with. It seemed to me that for a while we were getting away from that, and we were actually taking countries off the list, like Cuba, for example, which shouldn't have been on the list in the first place. But this really would be a serious, dramatic escalation to put Venezuela on the list when there's literally no evidence at all of state sponsorship of terrorism. Now, this is something that's being pushed by Senator Marco Rubio, the Republican of Florida, who says that Venezuela is providing material support for Hezbollah, for the FARC, and for other groups. What do you make of that? What can you tell us about those groups?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, the escalation, U.S.-backed escalation and aggression against Venezuela is continuing at a very fast pace. I want to remind listeners that, you know, this action, albeit somewhat surprising, is still in line with what we've seen in the last year or so, in particular, you know, with heightened economic sanctions, with U.S. military drills across the region, most recently in Chile and Brazil in the last year or so, as well as the ways in which, you know, the United States has tried to intimidate and bribe nations across the Caribbean to turn their back on Venezuela, which has been one of their greatest allies in the last 20 years through, you know, different types of economic support, intercultural exchanges, et cetera. And I think, you know, there is no evidence really that suggests that the Venezuelan government is tied to Colombian FARC forces or Hezbollah in Lebanon. And that's something that for years, you know, at a much lower profile, U.S. media and U.S. government officials have been trying to promote.
Yeah. If anything, the Venezuelans, along with the Cubans, have been facilitating the peace process in Colombia, whereby the FARC has gone through a process of disarmament and integration or attempted integration into the political process, after which it has, I mean, there, so many of its own organizers, leaders, former soldiers, activists have been brutalized. Many have been killed. If anything, it seems like the shoe is actually on the other foot, that you have Colombian paramilitaries carrying out terrorist actions against FARC or against Venezuela with the U.S. support.
And don't forget also that many politicians, maybe most politicians, recognize that this list is political in nature. And you have Republicans in the Senate from states like Texas and Louisiana that have refineries where Venezuelan oil is refined. And if we put Venezuela on the list of state-sponsored terrorists, it's going to impact oil trade and it's going to throw Americans out of work. So if you have no legitimate reason to place a country on this list, why would you shoot yourself in the foot and damage your own economy?
Well, I definitely want to go back to your point on Colombia, which, you know, Venezuela and Colombia have a very long shared history, you know, since pre-independence and through the independence struggle. But even more recently, as, you know, a lot of the international corporate media, you know, is trying to suggest that there's a Venezuelan migratory crisis. One of the things that they often do not speak about is the ways in which, because of the situation in Colombia, which is instigated very much by U.S. funding of, you know, a paramilitary state, essentially, in Colombia, there are at least over 5 million Colombians in Venezuela. And this is a country of approximately 32 million people. And so, you know, and Venezuela has never, you know, denied Colombian citizens their right to migrate into Venezuelan territory. So I want to mention that because I think that's something that's critically important for people to understand in terms of the ways in which Venezuelans and their migration, which has not reached any sort of alarming levels, but rather how it's been demonized and in many ways criminalized, and so much racist and xenophobic attacks have been waged against Venezuelans across different parts of South America by governments in particular that are aligned with the United States. And then in terms of the U.S. government in some ways shooting itself in its own foot, you know, one of the things in addition to this new proposal to add Venezuela to the U.S. list of state sponsors, you know, comes off of a wave of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela. And, you know, Venezuela is, I think, the fourth largest oil provider for the United States. And also the United States, November 1st, President Trump signed an executive order essentially sanctioning Venezuelan gold and Venezuelan gold exports. And part of the also recent sanctions prevents U.S. corporations and individuals from acquiring Venezuelan petromoneda, which is a type of cryptocurrency that Venezuela will begin doing business in. And so there are many ways in which U.S. foreign policy towards Venezuela has been promoting isolation of Venezuela, but rather what it's doing is isolating U.S. business and the U.S. government from a lot of these different economic and political ties.
Jeanette Charles is our guest. And I want to go back, John, to something that you said when you opened this episode. The state sponsor of terrorism list is purely political. Mm-hmm. The only so-called terrorists that are on the list are actually countries that have been targeted by the United States for their own overthrow.
Yeah, that's it.
And whenever the U.S. policy changes, their listing, their status on that list changes. So, for instance, Cuba was a state sponsor of terrorism, according to the list, for a long time. And then after protracted negotiations between the Obama administration and the government of Cuba, and a decision was made to reopen embassies in Havana and the United States and the beginning of normalization, the next day Cuba was off the terrorism list. Now, Cuba itself has been the victims of terrorism. 3,000 plus Cubans have died from terrorism, much of it based in Miami and much of it supported by the CIA. But it just shows that when the U.S. government wants to change its policy, the designation of terrorism comes off. If you designate a country as a terrorist country, in essence, it makes it very hard, not impossible, but very, very hard to also negotiate. You can't say about somebody, hey, you're a terrorist, but let's start talking about how we can get along better. In other words, it's part of a demonization, and it also triggers other sanction instruments designed to weaken those countries that have been targeted.
Yeah, that's the key right there. It's to further damage the Venezuelan economy and to cripple the country. I mean, the country is practically crippled as it is now. It has out of control inflation, unemployment is high, people are hungry, and then the U.S. response is to further tighten that grip. I wonder too, Jeanette, about the possibility of a military intervention. You know, the vice president hinted at it several months ago. You hear it bubbling up in the press every once in a while. Is there a legitimate military threat to Venezuela?
Well, I definitely want to go back and just kind of let our listeners know that there are a lot of different initiatives that the Venezuelan government and even grassroots movements have implemented to counteract the economic sanctions and the kind of economic attacks against Venezuela, which, you know, have varying degrees of success, but are part of, you know, kind of a series of both governmental and grassroots economic reforms, to say the very least, that I think are very inspiring and also offer kind of this other side of the coin that often media across the United States is very negligent in providing information about. And then in terms of a possible military intervention, you know, U.S. foreign policy and U.S. history in the ways in which the U.S. military has operated around the world, you know, has shown us that military intervention is definitely not off the table. Across Latin America and the Caribbean, histories of U.S. Military intervention, you know, have not been that long ago. You can look at the case of Panama, you can look at Grenada, we can look even at the ways in which the United States has began to prop up different military bases and expand military bases and military presence across Latin America and the Caribbean, most notably in Honduras and also in Colombia. And then I think, you know, the recent elections in Brazil are definitely a huge political game changer for the region, in the sense that, you know, it kind of in many ways is going to solidify some of the U.S. presence. However, there is a lot of pushback. You know, countries such as Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, et cetera, are, you know, not going to, I think, let this happen without sort of an international denunciation, which is something that we saw at the United Nations Assembly in September, where, you know, Venezuela, Cuba, and Bolivia very clearly denounced U.S. military intervention and military expansionism, and just the history of that. So peoples across Latin America and the Caribbean, while they're under siege by the U.S. government and U.S. military apparatus, I think are also very united in many ways. And so we will have to kind of see how things pan out. But of course, you know, people in Venezuela do not want military intervention. Ask anyone of any political stripe in Venezuela. And, you know, it's very rare that even amongst people who oppose the Bolivarian government, that they would want the U.S. to intervene militarily, because we've seen what that looks like in places across the Middle East and in Africa and even in Latin American history.
Jeanette Charles is our guest. We're talking to Jeanette from Los Angeles. She is a writer, editor, and solidarity liaison with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Jeanette, I'm so glad you have brought to our audience here in Washington, perhaps even in a short amount of time, a different view of what's actually going on the ground in Venezuela. We have 60 seconds left. How would you characterize the situation right now in terms of Venezuela? Obviously, there's a political struggle going on, but in terms of the mood of people, especially those who have been the historic supporters and followers of Hugo Chavez in the Bolivarian revolutionary process?
Well, I would say it's a definitely very challenging time, but also one of the most promising and most exciting times for Venezuelans as a whole. You know, grassroots movements in particular are taking the initiative to really radicalize the revolutionary process. There's, you know, a reparations campaign through the Afro-Venezuelan movement. Feminist organizations are fighting for the right to abortion and different sort of feminist demands. We see the sex and gender diversity movement as well, very vibrantly organizing. And then the communes are really trying to put into effect the communal state, which is one of the last political cries of former President Hugo Chavez. And so, you know, in Venezuela, there's so much happening that unfortunately U.S. corporate media does not want to show, and that consistently, you know, negates. And these are some of the stories, the testimonies, and the inspiring actions that I think a lot of people, particularly in the United States, would benefit from, given the political climate here and how motivated people are to take action, like we saw with the recent midterm elections, and then also in general with the different movements that have emerged in the last several years.
That was the voice of Jeanette Charles, who joined us from Los Angeles. Jeanette is a writer and editor and solidarity liaison with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump yesterday picked a Twitter fight with Pakistan over what he called that country's refusal to do anything to help the United States. Pakistan summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest, and Prime Minister Imran Khan took to Twitter to rebut Trump's allegations. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You know, it's not unusual now for the president to get into a Twitter fight with somebody, even another world leader. But this one was very interesting because, in my view, Trump sounded shrill and Imran Khan came back and he laid out the facts. I want to read a couple of these tweets. There were a lot of them. I won't read all of them. But the first two are from the president. He says, number one, we no longer pay Pakistan the billions of dollars because they would take our money and do nothing for us. Bin Laden being a prime example, Afghanistan being another. They were just one of many countries that take from the United States without giving anything in return. That's ending, in capital letters and exclamation point. He went on, of course, we should have captured Osama bin Laden long before we did. I pointed him out in my book just before the attack on the World Trade Center. President Clinton famously missed his shot. We paid Pakistan billions of dollars and they never told us he was living there. Fools! Exclamation point. That's shrill to me. And then Imran Khan comes back and says, the record needs to be put straight on Mr. Trump's tirade against Pakistan. Number one, no Pakistani was involved in 9/11, but Pakistan decided to participate in the U.S. war on terror. Number two, Pakistan suffered 75,000 casualties in this war, and over $123 billion was lost in the economy. U.S. aid, in quotation marks, was a minuscule $20 billion. And then he went on. Instead of making Pakistan a scapegoat for their failures, the U.S. should do a serious assessment of why, despite 140,000 NATO troops, plus 250,000 Afghan troops, and reportedly $1 trillion spent on the war in Afghanistan, the Taliban today are stronger than before. Wow. What do you make of this?
Well, it couldn't have come at a worse time. Here is the United States desperately trying to find some way out of Afghanistan through arranging a political settlement whose odds are, you know, are not good. But there we are, very much engaged in it. We've got Ambassador Khalilzad there right now, and he's maybe under a deadline here to get something accomplished by the time of the elections in Afghanistan scheduled for April. Or the U.S. may just turn its back on Afghanistan. At least many people believe that's a possibility. So it's hard to imagine that you can arrange this kind of political outcome without Pakistan. Pakistan is not in a position to make things happen so much as it's in a position to play spoiler if it feels that its interests are not being served. So this is a time when we have to be doing everything we can to make sure, assuming that there can be progress toward a peaceful settlement, that Pakistan is on board for this. This kind of exchange sets that back. It means here that we're more likely to see Pakistan play hardball with the United States, where it's not going to take some risks that it would in the kind of deal that could be struck. So I think what comes at me here is President Trump did not utter his remarks out of some strategic view that he has here where these were going to be helpful. They just come off the top of his head. This is the kind of rhetoric that he has used repeatedly. And he just went back, really, building on something that he had said the very first day of this year when he tweeted things that were really quite disrespectful. Any country would take umbrage from those kinds of remarks, and I think that's what we're seeing here as well.
Marvin Weinbaum is our guest. New story, John, breaking news, another big bombing, a suicide bombing in Kabul. I'm looking at the Washington Post. Explosion rips through large Sunni gathering in Kabul, killing at least 40, many, many more wounded.
Oh, gee. I haven't seen that, but it's almost every day now that we have something like that. And it's interesting that they mention here Sunni, because many of the bombings that have been taking place have been credited, or the credit has been taken by ISIS or Islamic State, Daesh, and they've been aimed at the Hazara community, which is largely Shiite. This is just a reminder here, to me at least, that the Taliban is not interested in serious peace negotiations. This isn't simply all part, as you hear some people say, well, they're just toughening their position, you know, bargaining position when they go in. No, the message that they're sending here is that they don't want any part of the political system in Afghanistan right now. They are determined here to see through as much as they can some kind of military victory. You know, we say military victories are not possible, but if you have infinite time, and the Taliban have always demonstrated that they're not impatient, that they believe that is a possibility. In the end, I don't think that they will, because in the end, if the government fails, if the state falls, there will be a bloody civil war. There won't be simply it's being replaced by a Taliban regime. And that kind of outcome, a bloody civil war, isn't good for anyone. None of the countries in the neighborhood would really gain from seeing chaos in the country, and for that matter, even seeing a Taliban victory, What they need is stability in Afghanistan. They need a cooperative country because geographically it's so important to the future of the whole region, as it is a kind of crossroads for Central and South Asia.
Go ahead, John.
I was going to ask Dr. Weinbaum if there is some sort of a long-term strategy here on the part of the United States, or if the president is winging it. And the reason I ask is because during the Obama administration, we saw a concerted effort to improve relations between the United States and India. That came at a cost to U.S. relations with Pakistan. So we actually have poorer relations with India right now under the Trump administration than we did under Obama. And we have far worse relations with the Pakistanis under Trump than we did under Obama. So is there a strategy, or is this just a bad way to conduct foreign policy?
I think it's more of the latter. Actually, our befriending India in a big way started under the Bush administration. That's when the earlier as well. This is when we agreed to a nuclear agreement with India. But if there is a strategic plan here, it's a bad one. I can't see any gains from this. The U.S. has a strong interest in the region. It can't walk away the way it did in 1990 after the Red Army left Afghanistan. The U.S. pulled out from the region. It broke really off from Pakistan and just ignored Afghanistan. And of course, so much of what we're dealing with now occurred after that fact. But we can't do that today. Since 1990, the area now is a nuclear-armed area, which it wasn't then. It didn't worry then about global terrorism. Those two factors here are absolutely critical to the region as well as the globe, what happens. And let me throw into that the danger of conflict between India and Pakistan because of the nuclear weapons has enormous consequences, humanitarian consequences, economic questions, and also the problem here with proliferation as well. Nuclear proliferation. So we can't be out of the region. The question is, how are we going to be in the region, the United States? And I can't see a strategy which is built on the fact that we have to be around, and we've got to be around on terms that the region could find acceptable.
Dr. Marvin Weinbaum is our guest. 30 seconds left. Dr. Weinbaum, real quick on your part, we just have 30 seconds. How do you think the Pentagon High Command feels about Donald Trump's tweets picking this kind of a seemingly gratuitous fight with Pakistan? How does it register?
Well, military will follow its commander, but there's no question here that this is registering at least in elements, higher echelons of the military. He's been at times friendly, at other times disrespectful of the military, and of course his remarks with regard to the tweets between himself and a retired admiral just the last few days, just a case in point.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.